Welcome everyone to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a deep, detailed look at the Associated Press Evening Edition for Saturday, September 13th, 2025. I'm Chris Anderson, your guide through these latest headlines.
And I'm Lee Bradley, ready to help us connect the critical docs and understand the broader implications of these unfolding stories.
Our mission today is to thoroughly unpack this stack of sources, providing you with a complete and detailed understanding of each major story, its context, and what it truly means for us all. We've got a lot to cover, from the high-stakes world of international relations and domestic political fallout to surprising insights into daily life and crucial health updates. Okay, let's unpack this. We're kicking off our deep dive today in the complex world of international relations, starting with a truly high-stakes gamble by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On September 9th, 2025, Netanyahu ordered an attempted assassination of senior Hamas leaders meeting in Qatar. His stated goal was total victory and to pressure Hamas into surrendering after nearly 2 years of devastating conflict.
Right. And these leaders were specifically gathered to discuss a new U.S. ceasefire proposal, which makes the timing even more critical.
What's fascinating here is how quickly this move appears to have backfired.
It really does seem that way. Hamas claims its leaders survived, and interestingly, Qatar hasn't commented on their condition. But five low-level Hamas members and a Qatari security guard were killed.
So the immediate implication is severe.
Yeah. This strike has deeply damaged Netanyahu's global standing, which, let's be honest, was already pretty precarious. More critically, it strained vital diplomatic relations right when they were absolutely indispensable.
And that diplomatic fallout leads directly to Qatar, right? A key U.S. ally and an indispensable mediator.
Exactly. They'd negotiated two previous ceasefires, got 148 hostages released.
So by taking this shot in Doha, Israel has potentially burned its most effective bridge for negotiation.
Precisely. Qatar's reaction was immediate and, frankly, furious. Their prime minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, publicly said he doesn't believe there's anything valid left in the current ceasefire talks. And he directly accused Israel of abandoning the remaining hostages. Up until now, Israel had deliberately avoided targeting Hamas leaders in Doha specifically to keep that channel open.
So this really highlights a critical paradox, doesn't it? Sometimes the most aggressive military move can cripple your own political leverage.
Completely. It traps leaders in a corner they built themselves with no easy way out. And it leaves this stark question. How does Netanyahu plan to get the remaining 20 hostages out now? Especially when only 8 have been rescued alive and 51 bodies were recovered through those previous negotiations.
And what about the ripple effects on U.S. ties and Israel's domestic politics?
Well, President Donald Trump expressed being very unhappy about the strike. He apparently assured Qatar it wouldn't happen again.
But no threats of punitive action. No public pressure on Netanyahu to stop the war.
Not that we've seen reported here. And Netanyahu himself seems completely undeterred. He's even threatening further action if Qatar keeps hosting Hamas leadership, saying, quote, "There is no place where we cannot reach you."
And domestically. Does this hurt him?
That's what's really intriguing. There seems to be a disconnect. Mm-hmm. His hardline coalition is reportedly still firmly behind him. So his political future doesn't seem immediately threatened, even though the sources say 2/3 of Israelis want the war to end and the hostages home.
Meanwhile, the offensive in Gaza City continues.
Yes, it's expanding. They've ordered an evacuation of 1 million people there. And Israel has essentially brushed off calls to halt the war from the UN, the EU, even Western countries planning to recognize a Palestinian state.
It points to this growing international isolation that just doesn't seem to be swaying the current Israeli government strategy.
Not at all.
Speaking of the UN, the General Assembly recently took a significant step, even if it is non-binding. On September 12th, the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly backed the New York Declaration. What was the vote count?
It was 142-10 with 12 abstentions, a very strong majority.
And what's in this declaration?
It's pretty comprehensive, actually. It explicitly supports a two-state solution and urges Israel to commit to a Palestinian state.
Which Netanyahu directly opposes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It also condemns Hamas's October 7th, 2023 attacks, which is notable coming from Arab nations. But it also condemns Israel's attacks on civilians in Gaza, specifically mentioning the siege and starvation.
Hmm.
It lays out a vision where the Palestinian Authority governs all Palestinian territory, but that's conditional on Hamas ending its rule and handing over weapons.
Okay.
And crucially, it supports a temporary international stabilization mission under UN auspices. The idea is to provide protection and security guarantees for both sides, Palestine and Israel.
Yeah. Prime Minister Netanyahu remains steadfast. Hours before that UN vote, he explicitly said, quote, there will be no Palestinian state.
Yes, and reinforced that by citing an agreement to expand settlements, which would further divide the West Bank.
And the U.S. position.
The U.S. dismissed the resolution, called it a misguided and ill-timed publicity stunt, and even a gift to Hamas, reiterating its opposition.
So a huge gap between the international community and the key players on the ground.
A significant chasm, yes. The Palestinian ambassador, Riyad Mansour, sees the resolution as reflecting the world's yearning to open the door for the option of peace.
But the Israeli ambassador,
Danny Dannon, dismissed it as just theater, said it only helps Hamas and weakens the General Assembly's credibility.
So this whole conflict is going to dominate the upcoming UN General Assembly meeting.
Absolutely. It starts September 22nd. The Palestinians are apparently hoping for 10 more countries to recognize Palestine then. And all of this is happening against this backdrop of immense human cost. The Gaza Health Ministry figures cite over 64,000 Palestinians killed in Israel's offensive. The scale is just staggering.
It really underscores the urgency and the tragedy. Okay, let's move on to another critical global flashpoint, the Russia-Ukraine war. President Trump's recent comments have definitely caused some waves within NATO.
They certainly have. On Saturday, he posted on social media urging all NATO countries to stop buying Russian oil.
What was his reasoning?
He was quite pointed. Claimed NATO's commitment to winning the war is far less than 100%. He called the fact that members like Turkey, the third largest buyer, Hungary, and Slovakia are still buying Russian oil shocking.
And he thinks this weakens NATO's negotiating position.
That's his argument, yes.
Right.
And he didn't stop there. He also threatened 50% to 100% tariffs on China for its purchases of Russian petroleum.
Wow.
Saying China has a strong control and even grip over Russia, and that these tariffs will break that grip.
Has he done this before? Tariffs related to Russian energy?
Yes, there's precedent. He already put a 25% import tax on India for buying Russian energy, part of a 50% total tariff. And earlier this year, remember those 145% tariffs on Chinese goods? They prompted retaliation, though talks eventually brought them down.
What's also striking here is who he blames for the war.
Yes, he attributed responsibility to his predecessor, Joe Biden, and to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, notably excluded Putin from any blame in that post.
And then this rhetoric comes right after that incident with Russian drones flying into Poland.
Right, a really escalatory move on Wednesday. Poland, a NATO ally, shot them down.
But Trump played it down, called it a mistake.
He did. Which is a stark contrast to his own Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. Rubio called the incursion unacceptable and unfortunate and dangerous, and said NATO's response was appropriate, though he did acknowledge it's unclear if the drones were intentionally sent into Poland.
Still, a strong message from the State Department.
Absolutely. Acting U.S. Ambassador Dorothy Shea stated America will defend every inch of NATO territory, calling the drone entry immense disrespect for good faith U.S. efforts.
And allies are taking action, too.
Yes, Britain sanctioned 70 vessels involved in Russian oil transport, plus 30 individuals and companies, including some Chinese and Turkish ones, for supplying Russia with weapons parts. And the G7 finance ministers called for a unified front to cut off Russia's war funding.
But as we discuss all these high-level maneuvers, the human cost on the ground is just devastating. The AP sources paint a grim picture of Mariupol, Ukraine.
They really do. It's been under siege since March 2022. The start of the full-scale invasion. It's a powerful, tragic backdrop to all these political talks.
Humanitarian catastrophe.
Absolutely. Mass graves, constant shelling, sometimes one shell a minute, the reports say. The city completely encircled.
People facing severe shortages.
Food, water, residents melting snow just to drink, parents abandoning newborns because they couldn't care for them, widespread looting, over 2,500 deaths officially tallied, but many, many more likely uncounted.
The stories are just heartbreaking.
They are. 18-month-old Kirill, 16-year-old Ilya, a little girl in unicorn pajamas, all killed by shelling. And that story from the maternity hospital strike. The pregnant woman rushed through the rubble screaming, kill me now. Whoa. Her baby born dead, and she died shortly after.
It's horrific.
And the sources describe this as part of Putin's refined military tactic, crushing a population through starvation and violence. We saw it in Grozny in 2000, Aleppo in 2016.
And the misinformation around that hospital strike.
Infuriating. Russian officials claimed it was taken over by Ukrainian forces, that one survivor, Mariana Vyshegurskaya, was an actress. AP reporters on the scene confirmed those claims were completely false.
And the current situation there? Still dire.
Yes. Russian forces have seized control of that very hospital, trapping medics and patients inside. The deputy mayor, Sergei Orlov, predicts thousands more deaths. The despair in Mariupol is far from over. It's the brutal reality behind the geopolitics.
Okay, let's shift from those global conflicts back to events here at home, starting with a really shocking domestic tragedy, the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. This happened September 10th, 2025 at Utah Valley University. Kirk was fatally shot.
The investigation moved quickly. Tyler James Robinson, 22, from Washington, Utah, was arrested just 2 days later, September 12th. He's facing charges including aggravated murder.
And the motive? What clues did they find?
Some chilling details emerged. Robinson's family told authorities he'd become more political, really disliked Kirk's views, called him full of hate. Ammunition casings found at the scene were engraved with messages taunting anti-fascist stuff like, "Hey, fascist, think fast."
Wow.
And messages from a Discord chat, apparently involving someone named Tyler, mentioned a rifle wrapped in a towel, engraved bullets, a scope.
How did the community react?
Shocked. He was described as quiet, a former honor roll student. He'd even been admitted to Utah State on scholarship, though he only attended one semester. He was working as an electrical apprentice. And his parents, who are registered Republicans, actually helped turn him in after seeing the photos released by the FBI.
Beyond the tragedy itself, this immediately sparked a wave of misinformation online, didn't it? In those 2 days before Robinson was identified.
It really did. And this isn't just about one event, Chris. It shows so clearly how these engagement-driven algorithms, combined with our own biases, can just instantly weaponize information. It makes it incredibly hard for anyone, even people who try to stay well-informed, to figure out what's true during a crisis.
What kind of false claims were spreading?
Well, for example, Robinson was falsely identified online as a registered Republican. State records show he was actually unaffiliated, inactive voter status. There were claims he was a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. The group confirmed, nope, no such member. An old video of a different shooter from Reno was misrepresented as Kirk's shooter escaping. Other people were falsely named as suspects before Robinson was caught.
And this had political consequences immediately.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Prominent conservative figures, including President Trump himself, were blaming liberal politics for Kirk's death before the actual suspect was identified or his motivations known. It's a stark example of how narratives get shaped or manipulated in real time.
And the graphic videos of the shooting itself were everywhere online.
Instantly, multiple angles available on X, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Truth Social, often auto-playing.
Which brings up the whole content moderation challenge again.
Right. Platforms generally removed videos that glorified the violence or they applied warning screens. YouTube removed some content, lacking context, restricted age access. TikTok tried to keep it off the main For You feeds, added warnings.
But it highlights the ongoing problems.
Definitely. Fast-moving events, polarized public figures, platforms cutting human moderation staff and relying more on AI. And those engagement algorithms often push the most graphic, shocking stuff higher because it gets clicks and shares.
Unlike some other countries, the U.S. doesn't have blanket regulations against this kind of violent content online.
No, not like the U.K., for instance, where they could levy huge fines up to £18 million or 10% of revenue and even hold senior managers criminally liable for violations. It's a very different landscape here.
This brings us to another figure under intense scrutiny right now, FBI Director Kash Patel. He's facing a lot of heat, especially after some apparent missteps in the Kirk assassination probe.
Yes. Hours after the assassination, Director Patel falsely declared online that the subject was in custody.
But that wasn't true.
No. The two men initially detained were quickly released. He did correct himself later, but the damage was kind of done. Former FBI executives quoted in the sources called it a slip that made the FBI look like the Keystone Cops.
Ouch.
Apparently, Patel later vented to FBI staff about being kept out of the loop initially. Though, to be fair, he did later take credit for publicizing Robinson's photos, which led to his father recognizing him and Robinson turning himself in. And President Trump supported Patel, saying he and the FBI have done a great job.
Still, this episode adds to the extraordinary pressure the sources say Patel is under. And he's facing congressional oversight hearings this week?
He is, yes. And Democrats have a lot of concerns. There's been a purge of senior executives, names like Brian Driscoll, Spencer Evans, Steve Jensen, which has actually led to a lawsuit alleging a Trump administration retribution campaign. They're also questioning Patel's focus on pursuing President Trump's grievances, especially around the Russia investigation, and his significant realignment of the FBI's resources and priorities.
What kind of realignment?
Well, it seems there's been a noticeable shift away from the Bureau's traditional focus on complex areas like counterintelligence and public corruption.
Towards what?
Towards fighting illegal immigration and street crime. They even disbanded a federal corruption squad in Washington, according to these reports.
Interesting. Any other concerns being raised?
Yes. Questions about how files from the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case are being handled. Internal issues, too, adding a co-deputy director, Dan Bongino, using polygraphs on agents to find leaks, high turnover in field office leadership. Apparently, the head of the Salt Lake City office was pushed out just weeks before Kirk's killing.
And the Russia probe is back.
It seems so. The FBI and Justice Department, under Patel and Attorney General Pam Bondi, are involved in a new, highly political inquiry into the old Trump-Russia investigation. They're directing evidence to a grand jury, requesting info from former officials like James Comey and John Brennan. Critics see this as an attempt to distract from the backlash over the Epstein investigation.
Meanwhile, Patel and Bongino are promoting arrests under Operation Summer Heat.
Right, thousands of arrests, many apparently immigration-related. They're framing it as showing what happens when you let good cops be good cops.
These internal FBI issues seem to mirror that wider shift in administration priorities, especially on immigration. We saw a dramatic example with that huge raid at the Hyundai plant in Georgia.
Yes, that was on September 4th. Yeah. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, conducted this massive raid at a Hyundai site in Ellabelle, Georgia, nearly 500 workers detained.
Described as the largest raid of its kind in two decades.
And the impact on families was immediate and devastating. Nonprofits like Grow Initiative and Migrant Equity Southeast were just overwhelmed with calls. Panicked families, many losing their only breadwinner overnight. Kids left without transport, without basic necessities. It's a crisis situation for them.
What happened to those detained?
The majority of the 475 detained Koreans returned to South Korea. But many non-Korean immigrants are stuck in legal limbo. And lawyers are reporting that some clients who actually had legal authorization, like DACA recipients, asylum seekers, people with valid Georgia driver's licenses, were still detained.
Which raises serious questions about how people were selected for detention.
It does. And lawyers quoted argue this raid signals a much broader crackdown by the Trump administration, basically redefining criminal to include any non-citizen.
And this hits an area already struggling economically.
Yes, compounded by the International Paper Cup plant closing nearby, which meant another 800 layoffs, a double blow for that community.
Reinforcing these policy shifts, there was also a recent appeals court ruling affecting hundreds of thousands of migrants.
Right. On September 12th, an appeals court ruled that the Trump administration can end legal protection, specifically humanitarian parole, for over 400,000 migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
Humanitarian parole. That allows temporary entry for urgent reasons.
Exactly. Now, this ruling lifts a lower court stay, meaning the administration can move to end these protections while the lawsuit continues. It doesn't change things immediately on the ground, but it clears a path.
What's the administration's argument?
That these protections were always meant to be temporary, and DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, has the power to revoke them without courts interfering. The Solicitor General, D. John Sauer, argued that trying to end parole case by case would be a gargantuan task.
But the plaintiffs disagree.
They argue DHS Secretary Kristi Noem can't just end protections wholesale. They say she has to evaluate cases individually and ignored humanitarian concerns.
What's the potential impact on the migrants?
Esther Sung from the Justice Action Center put it starkly. The ruling hurts everyone. It forces people with parole to choose between leaving the U.S. in less than a month or returning to dangerous situations back home, potentially splitting up families.
And this aligns with Trump's campaign promises.
Directly. Deporting millions, dismantling Biden-era policies that had expanded legal pathways for migrants. This ruling moves things in that direction.
In the midst of all this, we saw a powerful display of dissent from U.S. Catholic leaders.
Yes. Top Catholic bishops and nuns gathered at Georgetown University on September 11th. They openly criticized the Trump administration's hardline policies, saying they're tearing families apart and creating widespread fear.
How are these policies affecting church life directly?
According to the panel, families are becoming wary of going to school, work, even church, because they're afraid of being detained and deported. And that fear is apparently made worse by a Trump administration policy change that now allows arrests at sensitive locations like schools and houses of worship, which used to be generally avoided.
Did they share personal stories?
Yes, quite moving ones. Auxiliary Bishop Evilio Menjivar Ayala, who himself immigrated illegally, spoke about the pain and deep confusion he sees. Sister Norma Pimentel, a well-known migrant rights activist, recounted seeing Border Patrol agents crying after witnessing conditions at a detention center.
It highlights a real tension, doesn't it? Yeah. Catholic leaders often align with conservatives on issues like abortion, but they're fundamentally at odds with the administration on immigration, citing church teaching.
It's a clear conflict, and it's not entirely new. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops already ended partnerships with the federal government for refugee services after the Trump administration cut funding. Pope Francis himself has rebuked mass deportations.
The bishops also made an economic argument.
Right. Miami Archbishop Thomas Wenske pointed out the vital role immigrants play in the economy, in agriculture, service industries, healthcare, construction, and Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez reported a worrying 30% drop in mass attendance in his archdiocese, specifically because of fear. This impacts church programs and has led the archdiocese to step in with legal and financial aid.
They also raised concerns about public safety.
Yes. Panelists warned that when immigrants fear law enforcement, they become easier targets for crime, which ultimately undermines safety for everyone. Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso stressed the need to inform immigrants of their rights and just be present for people being terrorized by the actions of the government. It shows the church taking a very active, hands-on role here.
Okay, and finally in this section, a report from a Spanish source about a U.S. boat attack near Venezuela. The initial claim was that the U.S. military attacked a speedboat carrying drugs and gang members.
Right. The White House claimed it was carrying drugs from Venezuela and members of the Tren de Aragua gang.
But new information surfaced.
Yes. National security officials apparently acknowledged to Congress that the boat, which had 11 people on board, had actually turned around and was heading back to shore before the attack happened.
That raises some serious questions.
It certainly does in Congress. Senator Tim Kaine and over two dozen other Democratic senators are questioning the legal justification. They argue the military isn't an enforcement agency for this kind of thing, and Congress didn't authorize force. Senator Jack Reed stressed the military isn't empowered to just kill suspected criminals without a trial.
How is the Trump administration justifying it?
They're claiming self-defense. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said drug cartels represent an immediate threat. They've designated Tren de Aragua as a terrorist organization and are threatening more military attacks. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly said Trump acted according to the laws of armed conflict to protect our country.
What's Venezuela saying?
Their interior minister, Diosdado Cabello, accused the U.S. of murder, called the U.S. version a tremendous lie. He questioned how the U.S. even identified the people as gang members. Do they have a chip? A QR code? He asked rhetorically. He also doubted that the boat, described as a piñero, a small fishing boat, could even carry 11 people plus drugs for that kind of journey. Venezuelan authorities are investigating.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to the economy. We've got a pretty fascinating legal fight brewing over Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
Yeah, this is quite something. President Trump is trying to fire her for cause.
For cause? What's the allegation?
Mortgage fraud. The claim is she simultaneously declared two properties as primary residences back in June 2021, a condo in Atlanta and a home in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
But Cook has a defense.
She does. Her team points to loan estimate documents where the Atlanta condo was actually listed as a vacation home, and a security clearance form apparently described it as a second home.
So not primary residences for both?
That's her argument, yes. It directly contradicts the fraud claim. She sued to block the firing and actually got an injunction on Tuesday, so she's still in her post for now.
But the administration is appealing.
They are. They're seeking an emergency ruling, hoping to get a decision before the Fed meets next week. They're expected to cut interest rates by a quarter point then.
This seems like a really big deal, politically and for the Fed's independence.
It's huge. A Trump appointee, Bill Polt, who regulates Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department, which has opened an investigation. But the really significant thing here, Chris, is this is the first time ever a president has tried to remove a member of the Fed's seven-person board of governors.
Wow.
It sets a potentially explosive precedent regarding the independence of the central bank, raises massive questions about executive influence over monetary policy.
Okay, from high finance to high tech, Apple is making some big moves, both in U.S. manufacturing and with new products.
That's right. They've announced a massive commitment to increase investment in American manufacturing, specifically deepening ties with Corning's plant in Harrodsburg, Kentucky.
That's where they make the glass for iPhones and Apple Watches.
Exactly. The plan is for that plant to produce 100% of the cover glass for both products. They're talking about building the largest and most advanced production line ever created for smartphone glass combining Apple and Corning know-how.
Any other investment there?
Yes. An innovation center is opening at the plant for R&D, and the workforce is expected to grow from about 350 to at least 500 people.
Getting praise from both sides of the aisle.
Bipartisan praise, yeah. From President Trump and Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear. It definitely points to that trend of onshoring critical manufacturing, likely driven by a mix of economic and political factors.
Apple also just unveiled its new iPhone 17 lineup. What's new there?
The big headline is the first ever iPhone Air, aiming for a slimmer design to stand out in a crowded market.
And the pricing, especially with Trump's new tariffs and calls for U.S. manufacturing.
That's the interesting part. Analysts predicted those factors would double or triple iPhone prices if fully passed on. But Apple seems to have largely held the line. The iPhone 17 starts at $800, the Pro Max at $1,200, the new Air at $1,000. Only the regular Pro model saw a $100 increase, now starting at $1,100.
So they're likely absorbing some costs. What about features?
A big camera revamp seems to be the focus. Better quality, wider front camera view, landscape selfies, even simultaneous front and back recording on the Air model. More powerful telephoto on the Pro models. Longer battery life, too, with the Air apparently being the most power-efficient iPhone yet.
And AI. Everyone's talking about AI.
Incremental advances. iOS 26, launching next week, brings things like screenshot breakdown and live translation, a center stage feature for the front camera.
But still playing catch-up overall in AI.
Seems that way, yeah. Promised Siri improvements, for example, got pushed to next year because previous models didn't quite deliver the AI hype. So progress, but maybe not leading the pack just yet.
Any other new gadgets?
A few updates. New AirPods Pro 3 for $249, featuring live translation using on-device AI. Apple Watch Series 11 at $399, adding a sleep score and hypertension notifications, though that last one is pending FDA approval. And the Apple Watch Ultra 3 at $799, with the biggest display and longest battery life in their watch lineup. Plus, the budget-friendly Apple Watch SE remains at $249.
All right, let's shift gears now to a more personal sphere, lifestyle, well-being, things that affect our daily lives. Many of us can probably relate to this first story about Rachel Martin, 33, who realized she was spending over 12 hours a day glued to screens.
Yeah, driven partly by chronic migraines, but also just a lack of analog hobbies, she said.
So what did she do?
She discovered journaling, specifically with fountain pens and specialty inks. And she found it surprisingly social and tactile, a real departure from the screen.
What do experts say about finding hobbies like this?
They emphasize there's no single ideal hobby. It's more about finding a mix of small, enjoyable activities. Could be pickleball, cooking, gardening, whatever. These have a cumulative positive effect on mood and health.
So you don't need to dedicate hours?
Not at all. Start small. Even 5 to 20 minutes can reset the next hour, as one expert put it. Try lots of things. Think about what you enjoyed as a kid or what feels missing now. Maybe fitness, reading, social connection, creativity. Think of it like dating, one suggested. Find what clicks.
Good advice.
And make it accessible. Keep your sketchbook visible, flow right from work into hobby time. Set small goals, maybe get a hobby buddy. And importantly, don't demonize screens entirely. A family movie night is fine. It's about being intentional and setting limits. Viewing leisure as wasteful actually makes it less enjoyable.
That makes sense. Another big life transition many parents face is empty nest syndrome.
Right, when the kids leave for college or work. Parents often grapple with this really complex mix of feelings.
Loss, grief, loneliness, but maybe also relief, freedom.
Exactly. It's not a formal clinical diagnosis, but these feelings can be intense and hang around for a while, affecting mental health, well-being, even relationships.
What helps people cope?
Experts advise nurturing relationships beyond your children, and this is especially key for single parents. It's also important to acknowledge that this transition can feel much more intense than earlier separations, like when kids first went to school.
Is there an upside for couples?
Definitely. It can be a real opportunity to rediscover who your partner is and the love that you have for them, rekindle intimacy, maybe start dating each other again.
And developing new routines.
Crucial. Learning new hobbies, joining classes, lay making, exercise, volunteering, and it combats negative feelings and helps you meet new people. And of course, parenting doesn't stop. You're still involved, offering advice, encouragement. Technology helps bridge the distance now, too.
Okay, let's talk about remote work. It offers freedom, but the landscape has really shifted, hasn't it?
It really has. The appeal is obvious, like Kate Smith in the article, who traveled the world thanks to her remote marketing job. freedom, flexibility.
But it's much more competitive now.
Hugely competitive. Mm-hmm. After the pandemic boom, many companies called employees back to the office. So truly, roommate jobs are rarer now. You might see hundreds, even thousands of applications for a single opening. Smaller companies might offer more flexibility, but often with less competitive salaries or benefits.
So what's the advice for job seekers wanting remote work?
Employers' number one concern is productivity. So you need to show you're autonomous. Demonstrate good time management, independence, self-motivation. Have a strong portfolio. Highlight any past remote work experience and the communication tools you used.
Stick to similar roles.
That often makes the transition easier. Yeah. Get your foot in the door remotely in a field you already know. Or, like Courtney Sandifer in the piece, maybe convert your current job. She became a contractor for flexibility when her husband had health issues, though she sacrificed benefits.
Are there geographic advantages?
Europe and Australia seem to have more remote jobs available currently. And many countries offer digital nomad visas. But always read the fine print. A lot of jobs listed as remote still require you to live in a specific city or come into the office sometime.
It sounds like you need to be pretty aggressive in your search.
Definitely. Opportunities are scarce. Attend industry events, alumni gatherings. Good old-fashioned in-person networking can still make a difference.
Okay, now for something many might fantasize about. Napping on the job. Is it beneficial?
The science says yes. Enhanced memory, better focus. We have historical examples, too. Churchill, Einstein were famous nappers.
But there's still a stigma in the U.S., right? It's seen as lazy.
Absolutely. The federal government actually bans it, except in rare cases, which is quite a contrast to other places. Mid-afternoon siestas are normal in parts of Spain and Italy. Mm-hmm. In China and Japan, nodding off of your desk can even be seen as a sign of dedication.
So what are the actual benefits?
Marvin Stockwell, the PR firm founder quoted, says naps rejuvenate him, make him exponentially more useful and constructive and creative. But there's an art to it. Sleep expert James Rowley advises short naps 15 to 20 minutes to avoid that groggy sleep inertia feeling.
And relying on naps all the time might signal other issues.
Right. It could mean you need to look at your main sleep habits. Mm. Electronics interrupting sleep is a major culprit for many people.
Are any companies actually embracing workplace naps?
Some are. Ben Jerry's, Exela, Thrive Global, they offer nap rooms or encourage napping. Arianna Huffington, Thrive Global CEO, is a big advocate, says employees are much more productive and creative after a short rest. It really shows that disconnect between known benefits and prevailing workplace culture.
And finally, a simple habit many of us could improve, eating slowly. Why is eating too fast a problem?
Several reasons. If you eat a meal in 20 minutes or less, you tend to swallow more air, which leads to bloating and indigestion. Your digestion is less efficient, so you absorb fewer nutrients. Food can even get stuck sometimes. And critically, your brain doesn't get the signal that you're full quickly enough, so you're much more likely to overeat. Studies consistently link fast eating to a higher risk of obesity.
What are some simple solutions?
Mindful eating is key. Turn off the TV, put the phone away. Just focus on the meal itself. You tend to enjoy it more and eat less. Small behavioral changes help too. Try using your non-dominant hand or chopsticks if you don't normally. Take deliberate sips of water mid-meal.
And chewing more.
Yes. Clinical psychologist Helen McCarthy suggests just consciously chewing each mouthful longer. Even your food choices matter. Ultra-processed foods are often soft and easy to gobble down quickly. Vegetables and protein require more chewing, naturally slowing you down. One patient apparently found potato chips unpalatable after learning to eat them slowly. Shows how powerful this simple change can be.
Okay, let's move on to some unique cultural and environmental notes from around the globe, starting with Ghana's fascinating fantasy coffins.
Yes, these Ababu or proverb coffins, mm-hmm. They're an incredibly colorful celebration of life and legacy.
Crafted to embody the person's essence.
Exactly. So a farmer might be laid to rest in a coffin shaped like a tool they used, a fishmonger in a fish-shaped coffin. The symbolism is really rich. Lion-shaped coffins signify power, often used for chiefs. Rooster designs might be for royal families in certain areas. The design reflects identity, occupation, status. It's never random.
And this tradition has spread.
It started among the Ga people, but is now widespread across Ghana. Nicholas Ablor-Enan's family, mentioned in the source, runs it as a business. There's even growing international interest, with some coffins commissioned purely as museum art pieces.
How does it affect the funerals themselves?
It really transforms the atmosphere. The craftsmanship, the vivid colors, they captivate mourners. It seems to soften the sorrow with this burst of creativity and celebration of the person's life.
From Ghana to California, we find giant trolls with an environmental message.
Right. These are by the Danish recycle artist Thomas Dambo. He creates these huge wooden trolls, some up to 40 feet tall, entirely out of trash.
Wow. His latest installation is called Trolls Save the Humans.
That's the one. Dambo has built over 1,000 trolls in more than 20 countries. Six of them are currently on display at Filoli, that historic estate in Woodside, California.
And they have a message.
They do. According to Dambo, the trolls who live for thousands of years, giving them a long-term view, don't like humans much because we waste resources and pollute. Each troll in the exhibit is shown doing something positive, building birdhouses, planting flowers, making jewelry from garbage.
So the goal is to inspire people.
Yeah, to connect with nature, think more critically about waste and recycling. Apparently, his exhibitions draw about 4.5 million visitors globally each year.
Now, shifting to a more sensitive cultural symbol, Finland's lingering swastikas, they still appear on some Air Force flags.
They do, but the report says they are on the way out.
Why the change now?
Finland's defense forces started a plan in 2023, the year Finland joined NATO, to renew unit flags. They claim it's unrelated to NATO, but the source suggests the real reason is the symbol becoming embarrassing in international contexts.
How did it end up on Finnish military insignia in the first place?
It was adopted back in 1918 after independence from Russia. A Swedish count, Erik von Rosen, who was actually the brother-in-law of Nazi leader Hermann Göring, donated Finland's first military plane, and it featured his personal good luck symbol, a blue swastika.
So it predates the Nazi use?
Yes, its use in Finland predates Nazism, but the association is obviously unavoidable now. It was used on all Finnish military planes from 1918 to 1945 and remained on some unit flags and decorations after the war.
And international pressure is mounting.
It seems so. There was an incident in 2021 where German Air Force units bowed out of a ceremony because Finnish swastikas would be displayed.
Wow.
With NATO integration, aligning with countries where it's solely a negative symbol becomes more necessary.
Okay, now for a more local, perhaps slightly bizarre environmental issue. Ground squirrels taking over Minot, North Dakota.
Yeah, Richardson's ground squirrels. City officials are apparently quite exasperated. Their numbers have grown dramatically over the last two decades.
How many are we talking?
They don't know exactly, but the estimate is tens of thousands. Possibly more squirrels than the city's human population of 50,000.
Wow. Why are they so hard to control?
They reproduce rapidly, litters of about six babies every year. They lack natural predators in urban areas, and they actually prefer mowed spots, like lawns and parks.
What kind of damage do they cause?
They burrow. So they damage driveways, sidewalks, lawns. Their holes are tripping hazards. They can carry fleas, potentially transmitting disease. There have even been instances of squirrels getting into homes.
Are they trying to control the population?
Oh, yes. Pest control uses snares, carbon monoxide, air rifles. They kill between 3,500 and 5,000 a year. Minot Air Force Base nearby also fights them, calls them dacracks, and trapped over 800 recently. School properties are affected too.
Is the public supportive of control efforts?
It's mixed. Some people find them cute and apparently sabotage traps or confront the pest control workers. But the expert quoted, Joshua Herman, stresses they are a vermin and a pest and dangerous when they are allowed to proliferate in such numbers.
And for our last unique note, a really startling encounter off the New Hampshire coast. A whale capsized a fishing boat.
Yes, on Tuesday near Rye, New Hampshire, a whale surfaced right underneath a 23-foot fishing boat.
Were the fishermen okay?
Thankfully, yes. Two fishermen, Ryland Kenny and his companion, were thrown into the water, but rescued quickly by Good Samaritans, two young brothers nearby. No injuries reported.
And the whale
appeared uninjured as well. The fishermen had actually seen the whale earlier and were trying to keep a safe distance.
So it wasn't intentional?
Likely not. Sarah Morris from the UNH Shoals Marine Laboratory suggested the whale was probably lunge feeding, coming up fast for fish, and just didn't know the boat was right there. A powerful reminder of the wild ocean.
All right, let's turn our attention now to public health, science, and the environment. Starting with some pretty controversial moves by the Trump administration regarding vaccines.
Yes, the administration plans to award a no-bid contract to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, specifically to investigate a potential link between vaccinations and autism.
A link science has largely debunked.
Right, overwhelmingly so. U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's a well-known anti-vaccine voice, announced this massive testing and research effort to find autism's cause, having repeatedly tried to connect it to vaccines. The RPI professor cited Jürgen Hahn is known for using AI and machine learning on blood samples of children with autism. They're claiming he has a unique ability to link data.
But the scientific consensus
is clear. Decades of research, millions of children studied, have ruled out a link between vaccines and autism. There's no credible association. Autism causes are complex genetics, parental age, health factors, chemical exposures.
So this research plan is facing criticism.
Strong criticism. Alicia Halliday from the Autism Science Foundation questions RPI's suitability, the lack of transparency around the contract, and, frankly, why they're spending funds to reinvestigate an already debunked question. It looks politically motivated.
There are also issues with accessing vaccine safety data.
Yes. HHS officials have apparently struggled to get access to CDC vaccine safety data. It's controlled by medical research organizations under contracts that are two decades old.
Okay, shifting from vaccines to food dyes. U.S. ice cream makers have pledged to stop using artificial dyes.
That's the report. Makers representing 90% of the U.S. supply have pledged to remove 7 specific petroleum-based artificial dyes. Red 3, Red 40, Green 3, Blue 1, Blue 2, Yellow 5, Yellow 6 by 2028.
Is this driven by the administration?
It seems to be the latest voluntary effort by food manufacturers responding to administration calls. FDA Commissioner Marty Makary called it a renaissance moment for health.
But does removing dyes actually make ice cream healthy?
That's the criticism from nutrition experts like Deanna Holscher. She points out that ice cream is still high in added sugars and saturated fat, and that's what people should focus on. Interestingly, Makary hinted that new federal dietary guidelines might challenge the established links between saturated fat and heart disease, which would be a major shift.
And Health Secretary Kennedy played a role here, too.
Yes. He's been critical of these dyes and pressured manufacturers. They plan to switch to natural dyes from fruit juices and plant extracts. The FDA also recently approved a new blue dye derived from gardenias.
What about Red 3 specifically? Wasn't that banned?
It was banned in cosmetics in January because it caused cancer in lab rats, though not proven in humans. Food makers have until 2027 to remove it from food, but Makary urged them to speed that up.
Is everyone convinced this voluntary pledge will work?
Thomas Galligan from the Center for Science in the Public Interest is skeptical. He warns that voluntary action doesn't guarantee full compliance across the board.
On a much sadder note, a child recently died in Los Angeles from a rare measles complication.
Yes, a truly tragic case. The child died from subacute sclerosing canencephalitis, or SSPE. It's a devastating complication that develops years after having measles.
How rare is it? And how severe?
It's rare, occurring in about 1 in 10,000 measles cases overall. But the risk is much higher for infants who get measles, about 1 in 600. And SSPE is almost always fatal.
And measles cases are up this year?
Sadly, yes. 2025 is the worst year for measles in the U.S. in over 3 decades. Over 1,450 cases reported, and unfortunately, 3 deaths. This resurgence is directly linked to declining childhood vaccination rates, leading to outbreaks.
The MMR vaccine is still the best prevention.
Absolutely. It's 97% effective after 2 doses, recommended at 12, 15 months, and again at 4, 6 years. This just highlights how crucial maintaining high vaccination rates is.
Now, regarding COVID-19 vaccines, the federal guidance has changed significantly this year.
It has. Unlike previous years, the feds no longer recommend COVID-19 vaccines for nearly everyone. The FDA approval is now only for those 65 and older, and for younger adults or children with specific risk factors, like asthma or obesity.
And states are responding to ease access, despite the narrower recommendation.
Yes, at least 14 states, mostly led by Democratic governors, but also including Republican-led Virginia, have issued orders this month to make access easier. Governors in Arizona, Illinois, Maine, North Carolina just signed orders on Friday.
How does this affect pharmacies?
Well, CVS Health, the largest chain, is now offering shots without needing an individual prescription in 41 states. Before these new state orders, they still required them in some states based on their interpretation of the rules. These orders are changing that landscape.
Is there a political divide here?
There seems to be. Democratic governors are framing these actions as protecting healthcare freedom against what they perceive as Trump administration barriers. Most Republican states haven't changed their official policies, but the shots are generally still available under existing pharmacy protocols.
We're also seeing regional efforts.
Right. California, Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington formed an alliance to set their own vaccine recommendations independent of the federal guidance.
And Florida's taking a unique path.
Their Surgeon General, Joseph Lodapo, announced Florida might eliminate some child vaccination requirements altogether.
Wow, all requirements.
The state health department later clarified it wouldn't take effect until December, and only some requirements, like maybe chickenpox, would become optional. Core vaccines like measles and polio would likely remain mandatory.
This all follows the firing of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee.
Exactly. Back in June, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the entire Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP. That's the key group that makes vaccine recommendations. He accused them of being too close to vaccine companies and replaced them with known vaccine skeptics. It really highlights this ideological battle playing out in public health policy.
Finally, let's address something many people struggle with. Anxiety about flying. Is it getting worse?
Anecdotally, it seems so. Psychologists and flight attendants report seeing more anxious passengers. And there was a noticeable dip in U.S. air travel back in March and April.
Was there a specific trigger?
Many point to that horrific American Airlines jet helicopter collision in January 2025. 67 deaths, the deadliest U.S. air disaster in 25 years. That definitely spiked concern. Even the FAA acknowledged air safety wasn't sufficient, and polls show fewer Americans feel safe flying now.
For some people, it's more than just nerves, right? Aerophobia.
Yes, that's the term for intense anxiety, beyond just feeling nervous. It affects an estimated 25 million adults in the U.S. It often seems to surface in people's 20s or 30s, maybe coinciding with new responsibilities like marriage or having kids. Bad flight experiences can also trigger it.
What are the symptoms like?
Intense feelings of being trapped, loss of control, feeling like you can't breathe, full-blown panic attacks. Flight attendants even report having to give oxygen sometimes to distressed passengers.
So how can people cope with something that intense? Trying to reason with it doesn't usually work, does it?
Experts say no. Logic and statistics about safety often don't penetrate anxiety disorders. What can help are techniques like deep breathing, focusing on longer exhales to calm the body's stress response.
And for more severe cases.
Exposure therapy is often recommended. It's a gradual process, starting with maybe just looking at photos or videos of planes, using virtual reality, then eventually taking short practice flights without the pressure of going somewhere specific. The goal isn't to eliminate the fear entirely, but to learn how to manage the feelings, to live with them.
And asking for help on the plane.
Absolutely. Flight attendants are often trained and willing to help. They might offer reassurance, hold someone's hand, guide them through breathing exercises. The article mentions Adeline Campbell, who had a panic attack eased by a flight attendant who then checked on her later. Sometimes that human connection makes all the difference.
Okay, let's shift to the green transition and energy. First, this idea of phantom energy or vampire energy drain in our homes.
Right. This is the electricity consumed by devices even when they're plugged in but turned off or not actively in use. Think chargers, microwaves displaying the clock, TVs in standby, gaming consoles.
How much energy are we talking about? Is it significant?
Surprisingly, yes. It can account for 5 to 10% of a typical home's total energy use.
Wow, that adds up.
It does. Directly increases your electricity bill and contributes to overall greenhouse gas emissions because power plants have to generate that extra electricity.
Are some devices worse than others?
Definitely. Internet-connected smart TVs are big culprits. Their smart wake features, listening for commands, can consume 40 watts just sitting there in standby. It's like 40 times a regular non-smart TV in standby. Anything with a clock display is constantly drawing some power.
So what's the solution? Just unplug everything.
That's the simplest and most effective thing for many devices, yes. Unplugging chargers when not in use is a good start. Then maybe unused lamps, the microwave if you don't need the clock. It seems small, but it's a significant contribution individuals can make to reducing emissions.
Anything else besides unplugging?
Check the settings on your devices. Disable extra features you don't use, like that smart TV always listening for signals. The broader point is about collective impact. These individual actions, if adopted widely, could reduce U.S. emissions significantly. One estimate suggests by around 20% per year, or 450 tons of CO2. It helps shift norms towards sustainability.
On a much larger energy scale, there's a controversial ruling out of Europe about sustainable investments.
Yes. A European court ruled on Wednesday that nuclear energy and natural gas can still be considered environmentally sustainable investments within the EU framework.
How did this come about?
Back in 2022, the European Commission included these sectors in its taxonomy, its classification system for sustainable activities. They labeled them as transitional ways to help countries move towards climate neutrality, recognizing that different countries have different energy starting points.
This was challenged.
Vigorously. Austria, which has no nuclear plants, and Luxembourg sued to get that regulation annulled. They called it greenwashing of climate-harming and dangerous technologies.
But the court sided with the commission.
It did. The court found the commission didn't exceed its authority and that, under certain strict conditions, nuclear and gas can contribute to climate change mitigation and adaptation.
What are the implications of this ruling?
Potentially huge. It could unlock massive amounts of private financing for nuclear and natural gas projects across the EU. Industry groups like Nuclear Europe see it as a major boost.
But the critics aren't happy.
It's not at all. Austria's Green leader, Leonore Geusler, is urging an appeal. She argues it fundamentally undermines the principle where it says green, it's no longer truly green. The fear is that labeling these technologies as sustainable will divert critical investment away from genuinely renewable sources like wind and solar towards what they see as risky and costly alternatives. It really raises that fundamental question about what truly qualifies as sustainable in our energy transition.
All right, let's wrap up our deep dive today with stories touching on faith, fraud, and defiance. Starting with a rather sad incident involving the Catholic Church's first millennial saint.
Yes, Carlo Acutis. He was just declared a saint on September 7th by Pope Leo XIV, known as God's influencer, for using the internet to spread faith before he died of leukemia at 15 back in 2006.
And a relic associated with him was stolen.
Just 2 days after his canonization, tragically, a third-degree relic, which means a small piece of cloth that had been touched by the saint, was stolen from a parish in Mérida State, Venezuela. It was kept in a glass reliquary.
Why is this significant?
Well, the timing is obviously poignant. And as the coordinator of the local youth group named after Acutis said, it holds great spiritual value for the community. Acutis was beatified, declared blessed, back in 2020 after a child's recovery, deemed scientifically inexplicable, was attributed to praying to him. He famously created a website cataloging Eucharistic miracles.
Police are investigating the theft.
They are. It's also worth noting the church had previously spoken out against people trying to sell Acutis relics online, which underscores the kind of value, both spiritual and sometimes monetary, attached to these items.
Moving to a very different and concerning story involving church leaders and alleged fraud.
Yes, leaders of a Georgia-based church network called House of Prayer, which has congregations in 5 states, have been charged by federal prosecutors.
What's the accusation?
Swindling millions of dollars in veterans' benefits from military members who were part of their congregations.
How did they allegedly do it?
By pressuring service members to use their GI Bill education benefits to enroll in the church's own seminary programs located in Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, and Washington State.
The GI Bill that provides significant education funding for veterans.
Exactly. And these seminaries reportedly collected about $23.5 million in GI Bill payments, covering tuition, fees, housing between 2013 and 2021. The current charges focus on $3.2 million from the Georgia seminary specifically.
What makes it fraud?
The key issue is that the Georgia programs were operating under a religious exemption that explicitly prohibited them from receiving federal funding. Church officials allegedly lied to regulators, claiming they weren't taking any federal money.
Are there other charges besides the GI Bill fraud?
Yes. They're also accused of using church members as straw buyers to help conceal the leaders' own purchases of rental properties, allegedly falsifying loan documents to do so. They reportedly received $5.2 million in rent payments from these properties between 2018 and 2020, and some of that money allegedly went towards the founders' homes and other leaders' credit card bills. The church founder, identified only as Dennis, is also charged with falsifying federal income tax returns. And separately, one pastor, Bernadel Semixant, faces charges of sex abuse of a minor. A really troubling set of accusations.
Finally, a story of defiance within the Orthodox Church involving a prominent American nun.
Sister Vasa Loren, yes. She's quite well known for her YouTube teachings, Coffee with Sister Vasa. An intellectual voice in what's often seen as a very patriarchal religious tradition.
And she's been ousted as a nun. Why?
Because she publicly opposed Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. She was quite outspoken.
What did she say?
She stated that Patriarch Kirill of Moscow, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, manipulates religious terms, spiritual concepts to achieve political goals. She called his stance supporting the war cynical and blasphemous.
And the consequences were swift.
Her bishop revoked her status as a nun and ordered her to stop all her media work. This decision was then ratified in May by the Synod of Bishops in the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, or ROKOR.
That's a branch of the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yes, it's semi-autonomous. But Patriarch Kirill, who has strongly backed the war, ultimately has oversight over Rokor.
Is this unprecedented, targeting an American Orthodox figure for opposing the war?
Lauren and her supporters claim it's the first known case of the Moscow Church extending its punitive reach to an American Orthodox person, specifically for opposing the pro-war stance. We know dozens of priests inside Russia have faced censure for dissent, but this seems to be reaching across borders.
So what happens to Sister Vasa now?
She maintains she is still a nun. She is now affiliated with the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which is based in Kyiv, and opposes Moscow's influence. She's been appointed a visiting professor there, and her new bishop, Metropolitan Yevstrati Zoria, praised her devotion to peacemaking.
It highlights the complex history here. Rokor was founded by refugees fleeing communism.
Right. They fled Russia after the revolution, were staunchly anti-communist, and only reconciled with the Moscow Patriarchate in 2007, keeping some autonomy, but still ultimately under Moscow.
So Sister Vasa sees this as Moscow cracking down on dissent, even in the U.S.
That's her perspective, yes. She called it church-sponsored cracking down on an American citizen in the free world. Another priest, Reverend Cyril Hoveroon, who was also defrocked by Kirill for opposing the war, lamented her ouster as Rokor losing the only prophetic voice it had. It really speaks to the global reach and internal tensions surrounding the war within the Orthodox world.
Wow, we've covered a tremendous amount in this deep dive into the Associated Press Evening Edition. From the high-stakes world of international diplomacy and conflict, like Netanyahu's risky gamble in Qatar and the UN's push for a two-state solution,
to the unfolding human tragedy we discussed in Mariupol, Ukraine, and that fierce debate over NATO's energy policies.
We've also navigated the complex domestic landscape, the Charlie Kirk assassination, and its contentious political aftermath.
The FBI's internal turmoil and shifting priorities, and the profound impact of immigration policies on families we heard about.
And we explored the intersection of personal well-being, economic shifts, and some fascinating cultural trends.
Yeah, from new Apple products and those unique Ghanaian coffins to struggles with screen time and even those ground squirrels in North Dakota.
We've really seen how global decisions echo in individual lives, haven't we? And how individual actions can collectively shape our future.
Absolutely. And as we step away from these headlines, one thing that really stands out, I think, is this constant tension between information and belief. In an era where misinformation can spread just as quickly as breaking news and where narratives are so fiercely contested, how do you discern truth? How do you make sense of the world around you? What systems or practices do you rely on to stay truly informed? And maybe more importantly, how do you remain empathetic and engaged amid such a flood of diverse and often conflicting perspectives? Something to think about.